From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Fidel Castro is many things. He's, you know, vengeful. He's Machiavellian. He's quite brilliant. He's an extraordinary military strategist, but he's not stupid.
So why did Fidel Castro arrest dozens of dissidents, alienating human rights groups around the world and poisoning U.S.-Cuban relations? Today we'll try to find some answers as we look at the politics of Cuba. Also, one man's bittersweet memories of growing up in Havana before the revolution. And guitarist Ry Cooder reflects back on the 6 years he made music with the Buena Vista Social Club.
This is what we seek as musicians, you know, the ability to learn and be around great players and get to know people and get to know a form. I can't imagine anything better than that.
2 months ago, the Cuban government arrested 75, maybe 80 writers and dissidents. No one knows exactly how many. They were charged with subversion, and they got stiff prison sentences ranging from 6 to 28 years. The crackdown puzzled a lot of Cuba watchers. Why would Castro arrest all these people, and why now? Journalist Ann Louise Bardak has a few theories. She's the author of the book Cuba Confidential. Bardak says Castro is furious at the U.S. government for arresting five Cubans who'd infiltrated Cuban-American exile groups in South Florida. These men are now locked away in American prisons, some of them in solitary confinement. Bardak thinks Castro may use the dissidents he arrested as a bargaining chip, hoping for the release of the five Cuban agents. She told Ann Strangchamps that Castro may have other reasons for the crackdown.
The dissident movement in Cuba was entirely infiltrated by Cuban security. And you might well ask yourself, why did Fidel Castro do a show trial in which he revealed the identities of 12 informers that had completely fooled everybody in the dissident movement and the independent press movement and every U.S. official? Because there were meetings that were held at the home, the residence of the head of the U.S. interest section. So, of course, wherever these informers were, undoubtedly there were listening devices planted. This is what happens in espionage. So what I think Fidel Castro was doing in this show trial is he was saying, I humiliated your people. I have completely infiltrated them. And I think that was part of it, because otherwise people do not give up who their informers were.
In the news coverage I've read of the crackdown on the dissidents, most of the coverage has been kind of hard-pressed to come up with a really good reason for why Castro would have imprisoned so many people. But there has been mention of something called the Varela Project, a petition that was signed by some 10,000 Cubans, called for some reforms in the Constitution. Now, is that a factor in this crackdown?
I wrote in the New York Times Sunday op-ed page my reasonings, and I believe there's several. One is that Fidel Castro has been watching what's been going on in Iraq, and I think that what he has deduced is that regime change will not be limited to the Middle East.
On the other hand, from everything I've read, the people he's arrested never advocated the overthrow of the Castro regime or even any kind of foreign intervention. So, I mean,
that's
were they
correct.
Really much of a threat?
But Castro runs Cuba very much like his own private island fiefdom. He sees himself as this grand patriarch. And any acts that he views as a challenge to his authority enrages him.
Hmm.
And the Varela Project really hit a nerve. And it was more than 11,000 signatures. And I think he felt he didn't play his cards right when President Jimmy Carter went there, and he allowed Carter to meet with the Varela Project organizers and to give a live speech on Cuban television, which effectively allowed every Cuban in the island to learn about the Varela Project.
What exactly is the Varela Project?
Basically, what it sought was simply a referendum in which the Cuban people would get to vote on whether they would like to expand freedom of expression, more private enterprise, an amnesty for political prisoners, very basic democratic reforms. It didn't mean once you signed that it happened. It just asked for a referendum to be voted upon. This so enraged Fidel Castro that the minute that Jimmy Carter left his island, he immediately rushed out and began his own referendum to change the Cuban Constitution, forever enshrining communism as a system.
Castro must have known that all these arrests would really poison relations with the U.S. Was that something he actually wanted?
Well, if you listen to the dissidents and you listen to the writers for all these years, they will tell you that he wants the U.S. embargo, that he wants a certain chill. He doesn't really have a reason to blame his island's woes unless he gets to say it's this U.S. embargo, or that it's a pretty good reason to say that the largest superpower of the 20th or 21st century has done nothing but, you know, dog him with restrictions on trade. I mean, it sounds pretty good. And therefore, he has a way to scapegoat all his problems. I mean, what does he have to gain if all the markets are open? What happens if the embargo ends and Americans are streaming into Havana and Santiago de Cuba by the thousands, and they're all over the island, you know, talking to people about open elections and free enterprises? That would truly be a challenge.
I mean, put that way, you can sort of have some sympathy for Castro, who's trying to maintain a particular kind of rule. I mean, Cuban officials have complained about the head of the U.S. interest section, James Kaysen. You know, he's inviting Castro's dissidents to meet in his house. He's giving, what I've heard, seminars on how to run a free press and things like that. I mean, isn't that a deliberately provocative act by an American official?
I think that's also true. On its merits, you could say, well, what's wrong with learning how to run a free press and disseminate the seeds of democracy, et cetera? However, would the U.S. government be doing this in Riyadh? I don't think so. Would we be doing it in Beijing? No. Would we be doing it in any other country besides Cuba? Unlikely. It is a provocative action, but that has been the mandate of this administration.
Well, and it's interesting that every time there's any serious talk about lifting the embargo, something comes up that sabotages that.
Well, Fidel Castro, I must say, is cornered the monopoly on sabotaging efforts to lift the embargo. Every time he's been approached by U.S. officials, he's done something extremely provocative. The most outrageous attempt was in the mid-70s, 75, 76, under Gerald Ford, when Kissinger and William Rogers, his assistant secretary of state for the Latin American affairs, approached Castro with a secret deal to end the embargo. And then lo and behold, Fidel Castro says, forget about it, I'm going into Angola. There's a revolution going on in Angola, and I'm sending troops. I'm going to send thousands and thousands of troops.
Well, and more recently, Bill Clinton was moving toward lifting the embargo, and then Cuba shot down two planes that were dropping pamphlets over Cuba.
Exactly. And it's not like Fidel Castro didn't know what was going on, because for the week before that, all his close aides were querying visitors and U.S. officials saying, well, what would happen if we did this, if we shot down those planes? And they were told in no uncertain terms that there would be outrage and undoubtedly the passage of the Helms-Burton Law, which tightened the embargo. So you have to say, when you look at this, when you look at the history of Fidel Castro, that he has really been out front in making sure that the embargo stays in place.
Why doesn't the U.S. just call Castro's bluff and lift the embargo?
Well, that's a very good question. Of course, that would be an extremely sagacious and audacious move. For one thing, you have the three Miami congresspeople, who are Lincoln and his brother Mario Diaz-Balart and Ileana Ross Lehtinen. They are dead set against that, and they do want vengeance. And there's a reason for this, and that is that the father of Mario and Lincoln Diaz-Balart was the former best friend of Fidel Castro, and there's another reason. They are all related. Lincoln and Mario and Fidel Castro's son, Fidelito Castro, are cousins. The two families are related, and there is a huge amount of bad blood going back to the 50s, when basically Fidel Castro declared war on them. And a lot of people do not know this, but Fidel Castro was married to their aunt. And when he declared his revolution, he basically declared war on their family.
But are you suggesting these single three people are largely directing U.S. policy toward Cuba?
They have a big say. They have a very large say. In contrast, you have now the Cuban American National Foundation. Now, you might say, how is it possible that they became the moderates? But they are now. They have looked at what's happened over 43 years, and they have said, look, it's not working. Let's have some engagement and try another method. And the latest polls over the last year have consistently shown a dramatic shift that the majority of exiles in the 60 percentiles now favor engagement in negotiations with the Cuban government.
Ann Louise Bardach is the author of the book Cuba Confidential, Love and Vengeance in Miami and Havana. She spoke with Ann Strainchamps. In recent years, the only way most Americans could visit Cuba legally was to travel with an educational or humanitarian group. But in the last couple of months, the U.S. government has banned nearly all of these trips. Now, our own Steve Paulson made it to Cuba just under the wire. So, Steve, how'd you get there?
Well, I went on a trip sponsored by the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's Institute of World Affairs, and there was a humanitarian component as well. Many American cities have sister city relationships with Cuba, and our group delivered humanitarian supplies to Milwaukee's sister city, a small city called Nuevitas.
Now, I understand you had briefings with officials at both the Cuban Foreign Ministry and the U.S. Interests section. Was there anything surprising to you about those visits?
Well, they both blamed the embargo on the other side, just as Annie Bardach was talking about in the last interview. I have to say, one of the things that really struck me was just the setting of the U.S. Interests section, and I think it shows how convoluted the politics can get. The interest section is in the building that used to be the U.S. Embassy before the revolution. It's now owned by the Swiss government, which leases it to the U.S. In other words, it's the American Embassy in all but name. And the U.S. interest section is surrounded by Cuban soldiers, and our Cuban guide wouldn't come within two blocks of the place. And then right across the street, there is a big anti-imperialism park that the Cuban government has built honoring Elian Gonzalez, the shipwrecked boy who was sent back to Cuba. And there are big demonstrations protesting American policy right across the street from the one official U.S. establishment.
I'm curious to know what it's like around the city. We all know Fidel Castro rules Cuba. Are there public monuments celebrating Castro?
You know, that was one of the surprises for me. There were actually very few public images of him, statues or posters or even postcards. He does not have the cult of personality that you often associate with dictators. The image that you see everywhere is that of Che Guevara. And when you think about it, it kind of makes sense. It's a lot easier to celebrate a dead martyr than the guy who is there, who's largely responsible for the rather grim living conditions today.
So is the revolution still celebrated?
Very much so. And you see lots of public monuments commemorating the revolution. And you also see lots of weaponry. For instance, at the University of Havana, there's this beautiful grassy square, and there's a tank sitting right there. And just to give you one other example, at Che's mausoleum in the town of Santa Clara, there's an enormous statue of Che, and he's in combat fatigues toting a rifle.
But I understand that they have relaxed some things. The Cuban government has, for instance, relaxed some of its restrictions on religion, right?
Yeah, well, from what I heard, the Catholic Church operates with fewer restrictions now, and an Afro-Cuban religion has started to come out of the closet. Santeria is the best-known tradition, and you'll sometimes see people on the street dressed totally in white. They are being initiated into Santeria, which originally was brought over by the Yoruba of Nigeria. And this became the religion of the slaves in Cuba. And today, Santeria is known for its gods that have very close connections to nature. For instance, there's Chango, the god of thunder. There's also a goddess of the sea and motherhood and a goddess of love and fresh water, just to name a few examples.
So where do you go to see the trappings of Santeria?
Well, there's a fascinating street in Havana called Hamel Alley, which celebrates Afro-Cuban religion. It has huge murals of these gods on the walls and the sides of buildings, and it's really quite stunning. The paintings are by the Cuban artist Salvador Gonzalez Escalona. And when I was there, I talked with the painter's assistant, alias Asef Alfonso, and he told me that the practitioners of Santeria have had to deal with a lot of negative stereotypes.
People thought that the religion, it was black magic, witchcraft, or something for black people. But it's not true. It's part of our roots.
Tell me a little bit about that. Where does that thinking come
because
from?
Because the slaves were poor people. And all the time, the Spanish government gave them a bad reputation because the Spanish, they were Catholic, and they thought that the religion of the slave came from the devil. And in Africa, they were cannibal. I don't know how to say in English. They eat people.
Cannibals.
But here in Cuba, it was different. But it depends of your mind, depends if you believe or not. Some people say the slave killed white people to give their gods. But maybe it's true, maybe it is not. But the intellectuals say that it was wrong. But now people think that with Afro-Cuban religion, you can solve problems. And that's the most important.
Santeria also has its own musical tradition. Drums are particularly important. They are considered the voice of the gods. And when I was in Hamel Ali, I heard a performance by the group Iroso Upa. I also met a filmmaker who's made documentaries about various Afro-Cuban traditions. Her name is Gloria Rolando. She herself is part of the Santeria tradition. And she talked about the long history of discrimination that people of her religion have faced.
They had to hide. They had to hide many things, many rituals, many ceremonies. But something that is amazing, that in spite of all this discrimination and exploitation, is something that is still alive.
Now, as I understand it, when the Pope came to Cuba a few years ago, that opened up religious life a little bit here, and then Cuba officially changed from being an atheist state to a secular state, and it allowed for more religious expression. Has that made things easier for your tradition?
The Catholic Church were more open. They could celebrate the Christmas. They don't have to hide. But, you know, in the case of this culture, the African Church is considered like a culture of resistance. But you cannot hide the drums, and the drums and the music you could hear in the neighborhood. So
when you talk about the drums and all the music, that's really a part of religious expression.
See, because the drums is not just a musical instrument. They are deities. The drums have a secret that we call Añá, that is a deity, and they have their own roles in the worship.
And one thing that I've noticed as I've watched some of the dancing here in Cuba is it's very sensual often. And I'm wondering if there's actually a part of that in the spiritual tradition, unlike, say, in the Catholic Church, where there's this clear distinction between sex and religion.
This sexuality in the dance is, we are Caribbeans. And the Caribbeans, you see how hot here is the weather? Our dances must be hot also. Yes.
Coming up, the man behind the Buena Vista Social Club, Rai Cooter, talks about the irresistible rhythms of Cuban music. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Buena Vista Social Club is the top-selling record in the history of world music. When it came out 6 years ago, it not only put Cuban music on the map, it added to the legend of the record's producer, Rai Cooter. Cooter himself is a renowned guitarist, but over the years he's pursued a quirky, independent career, largely shunning the world of commercial music. But Cuban music grabbed his attention, and he went on to produce several records with great old Cuban musicians. Now, Cooter has two new albums out, a record by singer Ibrahim Ferrer and an instrumental album he made with fellow guitarist Manuel Galban, who was himself a legend with the old Cuban doo-wop group Los Zofiros. This album, Mambo Sinuendo, is the first record Cooter has released under his own name in the last decade, and it sounds nothing like the Buena Vista albums. Ry Cooter told Steve Paulson that's no accident.
Buena Vista is a kind of an experience you have as you sit there with the group, you know, the big group, the old-time great players, and you try to, records have to have a kind of an identity in my mind. You know, they should represent something. It's an experience. It's not just a bunch of tunes. And so Mambo's Innuendo, if it was going to be a record of myself and Manuel Galban, it's a totally different idea, where we play instrumental music that has to be sort of layered and built. You know, it's not just something you toss off, and they have to be thought of sonically more than anything else. If you're not singing, then you don't have narrative and you don't have the characteristic or the personality of the singer, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to really look at these things, I do, as these little sound environments.
Now, you've described this album, at least the goal of this album, is making ultra-high-grade jukebox music.
Right.
What do you mean by that?
Well, jukebox music, for me, is you have a 3-minute song, sometimes a little more, a little less, you know. The idea being you put your nickel or your dime in there. It's like a joyride. You sit there and maybe you have a drink or two and you listen and you're supposed to be taken care of by this, I think. So therefore, it has to be good. I mean, it has to be dramatic and it has to sound beautiful and somebody has to do something in a hurry. You don't have much time, right? So these records, we all think of doo-wop and the classic records of the 50s, the 45 singles. They were masterpieces, I thought, miniature masterpieces, of course, you know. Not just the sound, but the statements, the romantic statements that were being made.
Now, is this really hearkening back to the jukeboxes of the 50s? I mean, is that sort of the kind of sound that you're after?
Well, yeah, that's the time of the jukebox. Not anymore. We don't quite have these things now. They're not part of our daily life anymore. But as Galban has said, in those days, in the 50s, in Havana, if you can visualize these 4 or 5-story buildings downtown Havana, very crowded, very close together, very narrow streets, and very often on the corner, there would be this open bar. And you sort of stroll in there and you get your 10-cent beer, as he said, and a 5-cent play on the jukebox. And you put in the nickel and you punch the tune you want your girlfriend to hear, and she's upstairs in her apartment, maybe 3rd or 4th floor, and that's why you came there in the first place. And you send this song up. It's a serenade. It's your greeting to her. And of course, the buildings being so close together, the sound tends to reverberate, you know. And I mean, I just love that image so much, you know. So, okay. Therefore, it's something to consider, you know. We're sitting in Havana, and it does have this timeless feel. The past and the present seem all mixed together. And that's how it is when you're there in the studio every day, as we were. See, it's the natural thing.
But it seems like you were, on the one hand, hearkening back to the kind of music that people heard in the 50s, but yet you were creating music that never really existed.
Well, sure. I mean, listen, we're not in there to journey back. Every day we would come in, you know, what do you want to do today? What's anybody thinking of? Does anybody have any ideas? And the truth is, you sit and you play. You don't get too intellectual about the whole thing, you know. It's not like a plan or an outline. I mean, I have to tell you that very often Galban would say, Patricia, and off we would go. Basically, I have to tell you that Galban's a very strong individual, and so he's going to sit there and play, and you basically sit there and say, sure. And we all do, you know. And that works pretty well. And then there's times when you'd like to, you know, shift a bit and say, and therefore let's just throw something out there and see what he thinks of it. But if he knows Patricia, and he knows 5,000 songs, and he knows exactly how they ought to be played, I think. He's made these decisions somewhere along the line. He's got a very good architectural brain. So it works pretty well.
It's fascinating to hear you talk about this whole process of experimentation. I mean, I heard that you actually shipped down, 2 dozen cases of kind of weird instruments and various electronic gadgets and just opened them up in the studio there.
Laid them out. Well, you can't get anything there. They have interesting things that people make out of car bumper bullets, and they make cowbells out of them, and I love all that stuff too. And we try to have these things available, but you know, if you need something that you have, you won't be able to go home and bring it the next day, and you can't rent it like you can in Los Angeles. You can't go to the music store, there isn't one. They can play, but they can't find you. You can't go get stuff. You know, that's what they don't have in Cuba, is stuff.
Hmm. So what are some of these sounds? What do we actually hear on the album?
Well, you can hear a pedal steel guitar in here being played by me, kind of in a crude sort of way. They don't have that instrument down there. Never seen it before, as far as I know. So I brought my Bigsby three-neck pedal steel, and I always apologize to all the steel players, but you know, just the idea to bring one, I thought was good. Tuned to a six chord, and it floats in and it sounds interesting. You know, adds color, it adds something, a kind of dimension, I guess. Also, many drum surfaces, many different kinds of drums, from trash cans to electronics, because I thought that it was important for our purposes to break out of the typical Cuban percussion mold, which is, let's say, congas, bongos, a clave, and a cowbell. Because if you stay there with those things, you're liable to just pretty much start repeating things. And this is a great sound, but we needed to change, I don't know, the overall feel of the music. The most important thing, I thought, was change the rhythm.
What do you think it is about Cuban music that's so irresistible?
Well, there's no one thing. I'm endlessly fascinated by this tumbao, the bass patterns. How they find these great little abstract melody fragments and build these rhythm structures over top of this. So I feel that my main education has been in understanding this and trying to learn about this, because it really fascinated me. And then the lyrics to the songs that they write down there and have for 100 and some odd years now are fabulous. You know, they're such poetic little film scripts. I mean, these people really have figured out, you know, it's not moon and June. Some of them are, but a lot of them aren't. I mean, very complicated, interesting stories. Again, in a 3-minute song, it's quite a feat. Muchos grandes han cantado nuestra música cubana. Con sus voces han honrado nuestra bandera cubana. No olvidaremos sus nombres, siempre los recordaré.
You've also produced a new album by Ibrahim Ferrer, and you play guitar on some of the tracks. How would you describe Ferrer's vocal style?
Well, he's quite an unusual singer. In the Latin world, you're a stylist of one sort or another. You might be the baritone or tenor and sing mariachi, or you sing norteño, you know, or you sing salsa or this or that. What Ibrahim seems to be able to do is he can jazz, improvise over anything. He can make up stories, make up lyrics. He has an incredible talent, like a horn player. So it just means that he has a very interesting personality. You know, he's somewhat surprising, and of course very humble and simple. But musically, it's very rich. You know, I haven't met so many people like this.
There's one song on this album called Cuban Music, which is both a celebration of old musicians and also a lament for how they've been forgotten. And it's especially poignant when you consider that Ferrer himself was shining shoes for a living not too long ago, and Ruben Gonzalez had been reduced to playing piano for gym classes.
Who's to say, though? It was gym and ballet. I think it was pretty interesting as a thing to do every day. You can see the interest there. In other words, you're part of the community. Nobody's a great big star and therefore isolated, you know, from their neighbors and friends like we do here. I kind of find that appealing. On the other hand, of course, shining shoes in Havana is just horrible. It's just too tough. So this shouldn't have happened.
Now, the Buena Vista Social Club has been this incredible phenomenon over the last few years. I mean, the biggest phenomenon in the history of world music, from what I hear. And, of course, you had the film by Wim Wenders, which really ignited public attention. But I hear that you might not be going down to Cuba anymore.
Well, I can't go down and work, that's for sure. I mean, things being the way they are now, the embargo is being enforced, you know, as never before, almost, you might say. And the simple fact is, President Clinton wrote me a license to make these two records during a space of a year, and those kind of exceptions won't be forthcoming, and the variances won't be forthcoming, and I don't have any expectations at all of getting down there to do any work anytime soon.
Hmm. Weren't you actually fined $100,000 the first time you went down to Cuba to make the first Buena Vista record?
Yeah, it all kind of blew up, you know, the notoriety and fame of the thing attracted other people who wanted to go and have the same experience, and they started asking for the license they thought we had. Of course, there wasn't any such thing, and the Treasury Department got kind of inquisitive, and one thing led to another.
So you violated the Trading with the Enemy
mm-hmm.
Act.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You didn't know that you were trading with the enemy.
Well, I always had assumed that intellectual property, books or records or art in any case might be exempt, but we found out otherwise, you know.
You know, I suppose that in some ways you did what some people in the U.S. government were so afraid of. I mean, through this music, a lot of Americans discovered Cuba. Cuba became a less isolated place. And I'm sure because of these albums and the film that a lot of Americans went down to Cuba as tourists, either legally or not. And do you take a certain pleasure in that?
Of course, I've always felt that if I like something of the music, the people, the place, then other people will like it too. It's an assumption, you know. So I think the music for me is the door that I go through, and I think this is great, and there's so much to it. A very wonderful place, a beautiful people. I mean, very poor, of course, and all these problems we know. And say what you want, politically or otherwise, it still is interesting and worth finding out about, I should say.
Has the whole experience with the Buena Vista musicians, has that changed your thinking about music? Because I know for a long time you kind of shied away from doing recordings, especially you yourself.
Well, I didn't want to make solo records anymore, but the very thing I wanted to do was find people to play with. And I think that this was one of these tremendous opportunities that you very seldom, I mean, I sat in the studio with Ollie Farcatori for a week. That was just a week. We did a nice record, I thought, but, you know, this had been about a six-year period. I mean, really intensive. So, of course, this is what we seek as musicians, you know, the ability to learn and be around great players and get to know people and get to know a form. I can't imagine anything better than that. I really can't.
Ry Cooter's new album with Manuel Galván is called Mambo Sinuendo. He talked with Steve Paulson. Coming up, memories of a Cuban childhood before the revolution. And Cuba's national sport, baseball. We'll take you out to the ballgame in Havana.
Oh, I thought he was out. Wow.
Excellent play.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Carlos Ayer was 8 years old when Fidel Castro took over Cuba. 3 years later, he was one of 14,000 children airlifted out of the country. His parents stayed behind. Today, Ayer is a history professor at Yale University. His memories of how the revolution turned his childhood upside down are bittersweet. He's written a memoir called Waiting for Snow in Havana. The Cuba he remembers was nothing like it is today.
The Cuba I grew up in was culturally an extension of the United States. American films, American television programs, American merchandise. When I came to the United States after 2 years of having no American products in Castro's Cuba.
But there are other things about being a small boy in Cuba that you clearly remember that are so very different from anything that we read about here. The kind of jokes that you played, for instance.
We had a lot of time to ourselves without supervision. And there were a group of us in my neighborhood who basically just roamed playing pranks on neighbors, blowing up firecrackers on their porches, doing target practice with our BB guns on the bottles of milk on their front step.
Well, of course, this doesn't sound so different from an American childhood after all.
But we had no snow. We didn't have snowballs to throw at each other. So we threw rocks or almonds. I once got hit on the forehead with an almond and I passed out because when they're not shelled, when they still come off the tree, they're pretty hard. We lived a very rambunctious life, but we had different things to play with.
You wrote about your dad taking you car surfing, for instance.
Yep.
Can you tell me about that?
All along the waterfront in Havana, there's a very broad avenue, the Malecón. It has a seawall right at the edge of the water. And it doesn't take much to send the waves over the seawall, but when we would get a very strong storm, usually with a cold front coming straight from the North Pole, the waves would crash over the seawall and onto the street. Big waves, huge waves. And we would ask our dad to drive the car through these waves. And he did. And sometimes you felt as if the car was about to tip over. And certainly the water that came on top of the car came in such great amounts and so fast that the windshield wipers couldn't keep up. So my dad was driving blind under this water, and we loved it.
Were you and your family aware of the changes that were occurring in Cuba, the things that were going to change your life so thoroughly?
Many nights I went to sleep to the sound of gunfire off in the distance and bombs going off. So you couldn't help but know that things were out of joint and that some change was inevitable.
You even had a run-in with somebody who was running away from the police one night, didn't you?
We did. We were going home from my grandmother's house and were caught in a shootout as we were parking the car to run into a house for shelter. A man accosted us, grabbed my brother, and said, "Save me, please, save me. They're after me. They're going to kill me." But my father pointed out, "Look, I have two small children. My wife is handicapped," because my mother had polio as a child and only had one usable leg. Said, "We can't really help you. We don't live here. We don't live in this neighborhood. We don't know how to hide you. Go away, please. You're going to get us killed." And the man took a look at my brother and me and ran away. And the next day, we found out he had been shot. We saw his picture in the paper.
I was going to ask you if your parents prepared you for the change that was coming. I guess after an experience like that, you have to feel a little prepared.
We knew change was coming. They weren't prepared for the kind of change that did come. It caught most Cubans by surprise. And I think something that every Cuban knows, but very few Americans know, is that many of the young men who fought against Batista ended up opposing Fidel Castro. And not much later either, within the first year. And many of them ended up in the United States as exiles, and many of them were members of the Bay of Pigs invasion. These are men who had fought against Batista, who felt betrayed by Castro. Because it wasn't the poor people who rose up against Batista. Of course, this is the case in most places. It was the middle class, and it was the middle class in Cuba that was hardest hit by the changes that Fidel Castro brought about.
And we don't often hear about the effects of the change in the economy. I had never, for instance, read until you wrote about it, about being forced to turn in all of your family's money.
That's right. One day, one Sunday, suddenly every bank account in Cuba was wiped out. This was Che Guevara's idea to put everyone on a level playing field. But seeing all of your money disappear in one day was very traumatic for most Cubans, needless to say. Even for a child, I was 9 or 10 when it happened, and it has affected my view of money to this day. I expect something like that to happen every single day. Therefore, I don't have any money in a savings account. I spend it all.
You left, though. You were sent away, I take it, a couple of years after the revolution?
3 years. April 6, 1962.
And where did you go?
Well, I was part of the airlift that brought 14,048 children out of Cuba. And all of us would immediately go to these processing camps in Miami. And from there, we would be dispersed throughout the United States because the camps couldn't hold all of us. And a lot depended on luck, where you ended up. In the case of my brother and me, we were in the camps for a few weeks, and each of us was taken in by a different foster family in Miami. But then there was a horrible mix-up. An uncle of ours had arrived in the United States and had been relocated to Bloomington, Illinois. He was 62 years old and had to start all over again and had a family of his own. So it took him a while to get his act together, and somehow we got lost in the system. So we were supposed to go to our uncle's house, but instead my brother and I ended up in another foster home that was full of children that had already been in trouble with the law. And it was a horrible place. And from there, we finally did end up going to our uncle's house in Bloomington. And then 3.5 years after we left, our mother was able to leave and join us. She was told at the refugee center in Miami, well, you should go to Chicago, especially because you don't speak English and you don't have any skills. You can always get a job at a factory as an assembler. And that's what she ended up doing.
And so you were reunited, finally.
Right. But my father remained behind.
I'm curious about why.
This was very common, and it's very hard to explain. And in my case, it's harder to explain because I never saw him again. So all the communications I had with him after 1962 were basically by letter. He was crushed by the experience, but this happened to many families. If you left Cuba, you had to leave absolutely everything. All you could take with you, 2 changes of clothing. And many families had to struggle with this dilemma. Do I give up everything? Or should I hold on to it? No one imagined that this would last 44 years. My father always thought, this can't last more than a few more months, or maybe a year more. But a year turned into 2 years, 3, 4, 5, and he developed heart disease. And as he was making plans to finally leave, because he saw that the end was approaching for him, not for Fidel Castro, unfortunately, he died before he left. He died of a heart attack, and we never saw him again.
He was waiting for a change that never came. And you've mm-hmm. never been back, even though it's
no.
now possible to go to Cuba again?
Well, it's possible, but there's a hitch. They won't recognize my American citizenship. In Cuba, I am a Cuban citizen and subject to all of their laws and courts as a Cuban. And should anything go wrong while I'm there, I'm theirs. And since there is no American embassy, I think it's a little too risky. And especially after I've written this book, I wouldn't dare go. I'm sure they'll find out about it somehow, and I'll be persona non grata.
Carlos Ayer's memoir is called Waiting for Snow in Havana. And what does he think will happen in Cuba after Castro? Says he never thinks about it. The only Cuba he knows is the one he grew up in. Cubans are crazy for baseball. It's their national sport. Many Cuban players have ended up in the major leagues. A short list includes Minnie Minoso, Tony Oliva, Luis Tiant, Tony Perez, Rafael Palmeiro, Jose Canseco. So when Steve Balsen was in Cuba, he had to go to a ball game. Steve, who was playing?
One team was the Industriales. They're the powerhouse of Cuban baseball, sort of like the Yankees here. And in fact, El Duque, Orlando Hernandez, used to pitch for them. And they played the team from La Isla, the island to the south of Cuba.
And you found someone there to talk to you about Cuban baseball?
Well, it turned out that one of the leaders of my group, Raul Galvan, is an authority on Cuban baseball. He grew up in Havana and used to go to games there with his dad. Raul now lives in Milwaukee, but he still follows Cuban baseball. So when we were in Havana, we went to a night game at Havana's biggest ballpark, the Latin American Stadium, and I have to say, I had a wonderful time.
This looks like a good play. Yeah, yeah. Double play.
Yeah, like a third or fourth double play tonight we've seen.
Yeah, now those guys are pretty quick around second base there.
One thing that's really struck me since I've been in Cuba is I don't see anyone kicking the soccer ball around, but I see kids all over swinging bats and throwing balls. Why is baseball so popular here?
Baseball is at the heart of every Cuban sports love. It's been in the country since, you know, the late 1800s. Amateur baseball was huge in Cuba for many, many years. The Cubans have always been really proud of its major leaguers, of which there were many before the revolution. And since the revolution, they've been incredibly proud of its national team.
So it sounds like when you were a kid here, you used to come to a lot of games.
I did. I remember coming. There was, obviously, that was when gambling was big in Cuba. The casinos were here. The ballpark was no exception. They used to place bets as the game went along. You know, you'd place a bet that somebody's going to hit a homer.
It's like betting on horses for, you know, what's going to happen in a particular race.
Exactly. It's exactly. And I remember the bets were placed with a bookie who walked around the stands, much like a Coke or beer sales guy. And they had baseballs that had slits cut in them. And then you'd put the money, fold the bills up in the baseball, and you'd throw it at the bookie walking by. So,
but I bet that stopped once the revolution happened.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. They went the way of parking meters in Havana.
Now, there's a story, or maybe it's a legend, that Fidel Castro was an up-and-coming ball player, and he might have had a great career if other things had not become more important to him.
I think there is both a story and a legend. It was mostly legend. Fidel himself has admitted that he was a pretty mediocre baseball player, that he was actually a better basketball player, but being scouted by the Washington Senators was pure urban myth. Cuban urban myth.
What position did he play?
He was allegedly a hard-throwing right-hander.
Maybe a hard-throwing, but throwing some other things.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Wow, that was
excellent. Excellent play.
Oh, wow. Oh, that was it. Oh, I thought he was out.
Excellent play.
Wow.
Excellent play. Nice coverage by the pitcher.
Yeah, the first baseman dove for the ball and threw it on the ground, and great play, but the runner was called safe. Now, it used to be that back when the major leagues were segregated, some of the players from the major leagues and the Negro leagues would come down to Cuba, right, to play in exhibition games.
Absolutely. There were a lot of Cuban teams that played, and there were a lot of those Cuban players who played in the States in the Negro Leagues. You know, in those days, the Cuban ball players, the Cuban black baseball players, if they wanted to play big league ball, they had to do what American black players did, which is play in the Negro Leagues. Perhaps the best was a big, tall pitcher by the name of Jose de la Caridad Mendez. Mendez went on to play for the Kansas City Monarchs, as well as a couple other Negro League franchises. And, of course, later on in the history of Negro League baseball, there were some notables who actually crossed the color barrier, the biggest one being Manny Minoso, who played for the White Sox, who actually started playing Negro League baseball with the New York Cubans of the National Negro League.
Huh, which is fascinating. So he could get away with being considered white then in America.
No, by that time the barrier, the color barrier had been broken by... Now there you see the reason why some Latin ball players are considered hot dogs.
He was pretty nonchalant out there in right field.
Very nonchalant with a reasonably tough play, and it hit right off the glove.
He's kind of looking a little sheepish out there right now.
He is. He's looking to crawl into a hole somewhere which he can't find.
And then wasn't it when the major leagues were segregated, when some of them came down for exhibition games here, I mean, that was really the proving ground for a lot of black players. I mean, that was the one chance they would get to play against the white major leaguers. And often, from what I've heard, they beat those white
teams.
Yeah,
in fact, there was a team that came down, a Detroit Tigers team that featured, obviously, Ty Cobb.
Who was a notorious racist.
Exactly. A guy from Georgia. They played here, and I can't remember what the year was. It was in the teens. But they played a mixed Cuban squad of all-stars, which featured Mendez. And the Cubans beat the Tigers pretty handily. And there were other occasions when Christy Mathewson came down from the New York Giants, you know, in the teens and 20s here in Cuba. And John McGraw used to bring his New York Giants down here on occasion to spend a certain amount of spring training.
Sort of a different kind of cheer with the whistle here.
Yeah, whistles, and we don't have any drums tonight. Usually there's some conga drums, but I don't see any drums tonight. Oh, the hot dogs were good. And the sweets were good.
That was Raul Galvan talking with Steve Paulson at the Latin American Stadium in Havana. When Galvan isn't hanging out at ballgames in Cuba, he's running program production at Milwaukee Public Television. By the way, Steve says the equipment manager for La Isla did a brisk business at the game, selling autographed balls and jerseys and caps. Turned out the cap Steve bought was secondhand. He's still trying to figure out which player used to wear it.
Oh, look at that. Safe. He tagged up from first base.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Tim Fleming. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for The Cuba Show, number 68A. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, you can write to us at Wisconsin Public Radio, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706. Or send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. We'd love to hear from you.
PRI, Public Radio International.
What are the great country music singles? Patsy Cline's Crazy, George Jones' He Stopped Loving Her Today. What about the Rolling Stones' Honky Tonk Women and Otis Redding's Dock of the Bay? One list has all these songs among country music's 500 greatest country singles. Next week, we'll count down some country music classics onto the best of our knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.